Sunday, the 25th of October, Zion Cheshvan, Rabbi Dr. Asher Wade, from Pastor to Fum Jew, a path of discovery.
Okay, Rabbi Wade has given us an introduction, which he's asked me to read out, just to tell you who he is. And Agav, today's an extended shiur because he felt that he needs at least 45 minutes to say what he needs to say. But if anybody has a shiur at 10 o'clock that they have to rush off to and needs to leave a few minutes early, then they should feel free to do so. Our guest speaker this morning is Rabbi Osher Wade. Born in Virginia in the United States, Rabbi Wade studied at several liberal arts colleges and graduated Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy. Afterwards, he traveled to Scotland, where he earned a Master's degree in Philosophical Theology at the University of Edinburgh. Thereafter, he moved to Berlin, where he spent 5 months at the Goethe Institute in Research Studies. Whilst in Berlin, he also worked as an adolescent and marriage counselor at the U.S. Army Chaplaincy Center. After his stay in Berlin, he enrolled at the University of Hamburg, where he worked towards his first doctorate in the field of metaphysics and special relativity theory. Nearing completion of his dissertation, Rabbi Wade was offered a teaching fellowship at Churchill College, Cambridge. Rabbi Wade is also a convert to Judaism. His background is that of a religious Christian. Whilst in Hamburg, he was ordained a pastor in the Methodist Church. For 3.5 years during his doctoral studies, he was employed as the minister of an English-speaking Protestant congregation. Shortly thereafter, he met his German wife, whose father and grandfather were very pious Lutheran pastors. Several months after their marriage, he and his wife began to investigate Judaism. It took about 1.5 years for both of them to reach the conclusion that Torah Judaism fulfilled all the intellectual, academic, spiritual and emotional truths for which they had been searching. After withdrawing themselves from the church and leaving the ministry, both husband and wife traveled to Frankfurt and converted there to Orthodox Judaism. Rabbi Wade suffered the hardship of not being allowed to finish his first doctorate at the hands of his supervising professor, who, it turned out, had been a chaplain in one of Hitler's tank divisions which rolled into Poland during World War II. He and his wife, nevertheless, stayed on in Hamburg as he pursued a second doctorate on Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and the Orthodox Reform debate. 2 years later, with controversy still growing about his Jewish status, he withdrew from the university and together with his wife moved to the United States. Leaving the academic world and working in business for a number of years, Rabbi Wade was contacted by Nei Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore. This meeting led to him and his family being sent to Jerusalem, where he learned for a number of years at Yeshivas Or Sameach. Several years ago, Rabbi Wade picked up on his prior interest in pastoral counseling and completed a professional doctoral degree in clinical psychology through Southern California University. He is a member of the American Psychological Association and a former associate of NEFESH, the International Network of Orthodox Mental Health Professionals. As such, Rabbi Wade has a private practice in psychotherapy and is also an instructor in social psychology at Torah College, both in Jerusalem. And now it is with great pleasure that we present to you this morning Rabbi Osher Wade.
Thank you very much for the invitation, the opportunity to address the community here in London. I'd like to speak a little bit about my background. As you heard from the introduction, we could almost dispense with that now, but obviously from so far afield as my wife and I, to come into, of all things, Torah Judaism is for many people a wonderment. How could it possibly be? Here he is, an academic coming out of Virginia, majoring in, of all things, philosophy, one of those areas where he can make lots of parnassa from. Yeah. Then heading off to the University of Edinburgh in Scotland for a 3 years master's program in philosophical theology and a minor in science. After that, taking a private sabbatical, heading off to Berlin. At the time, it was West Berlin, surrounded by communist East Germany. There, I did research, took an internship as an adolescent and marriage counselor, After that, heading off to northern Germany, enrolling at the University of Hamburg to pursue what ended up being my first doctorate in a very esoteric field of theoretical astrophysics and ontology. Don't ask, but it was interesting. But also ever since the age of 16, back in high school, I've made a personal religious decision. I also wanted to become an ordained minister in my Christian church. So I kept my academic studies separate from my church requirements, and a year after I was enrolled at the University of Hamburg, I completed those church requirements and was ordained a Methodist minister by the visiting bishop out of Frankfurt. A year after that, still concomitant with my studies at the university, I was called into a church where I was minister of a congregation for 3.5 years. Nearing the end of that time period in the church, I met my wife, whose father and grandfather, very pious Lutheran German pastors. My father-in-law actually married us in one of the 5 cathedrals of Hamburg. And by that time, having finished writing the first rough draft of my dissertation, I went out on job interviews, and amongst other places, as stated, I was offered a postgraduate teaching fellowship at Cambridge, at Churchill College there. And at that stage, I guess pausing for a moment before we move on, I guess to summarize, well, without coining a phrase, you probably couldn't have gotten more glad Christian than my wife and I. So obviously, looking at the figure standing before you this morning, you could probably imagine that something strange must have happened on the way to church one morning. And interestingly enough, I'll be a shkoha protest, it was one Sunday morning when everything went topsy-turvy for my wife and set us on a path of discovery like unto which we could never have imagined before. What happened was is that for my wife and I, everything started, and I wasn't being facetious, on a Sunday morning. We had been 2.5 months married already. I was getting up, we were getting up that Sunday morning, November the 5th, 1978. And we were going through the normative lifestyle motions of every young pastor and his pastoral wife. That is, you get up Sunday morning early, you tune into the local classical music station on the FM radio dial for some mood music. You have breakfast, you peruse over the local Sunday morning newspaper to pick up some interesting tidbits to spice up an otherwise normally boring sermon, and then you head off to the local church or cathedral to lead the 11 o'clock minion. Church, sorry. Occupational hazard there, sorry. There we were lounging at the breakfast table, remembering Christianity we eat before we daven, like makes life a little simpler. And we'd gone through the first 3 sections of the Sunday morning newspaper. And as I reached down to the chair next to me to pull out section D of that large Sunday morning metropolitan newspaper, my eyes fell upon the front page pictures of that section D, and my heart literally stopped as I stood up slowly, spread it out across the kitchen table, and I said to my wife, "Look at this." There before our eyes on that Sunday morning newspaper, November the 5th, 1978, my wife and I were looking at photographs of large synagogues engulfed in flames. We saw other pictures of yeshivas and Beis Yaakov's firebombed. We quickly leaped into the interior section of the newspaper. In shock, we saw other photographs. The downtown shopping district with the storefront glass windows shattered and scattered out across the streets and sidewalks. We saw other photographs of rows of men being forcibly marched down the centers of the streets with funny little black caps on their heads, escorted by police officers, picture after picture until we caught the headlines of the stories and the captions of these photographs, only to see that the entire section D of that Sunday morning newspaper had been dedicated over to the 40th anniversary of the German Kristallnacht. That night of broken glass, as the Germans so euphemistically referred to it, was now being revisited over some 40 years later on this November the 5th, 1978, looking back to that fateful November the 10th, 1938. But there was something hauntingly familiar about these photographs, a sort of deja vu effect, as if we'd been there before. But both my wife and I realized that neither one of us were old enough to have lived during that time period. So we started backtracking through these pages again, looking and staring at these photographs, wondering what it was that was acting like a magnet, pulling us into each one of these street scenes, until we got about halfway through. It was a small, 1/8 of a size photograph of a huge cathedral-like synagogue going down in flames. But all of a sudden, we both paused for a moment as my wife put her finger on it. And I had already seen it myself. There was something so frighteningly familiar about this photograph. And at first, we didn't know what it was until our eyes started floating around on the picture, and then we saw it. It was something as mundane as the edges of this photograph. And then immediately, instantaneously, we saw it across the pages on two pages of the newspaper. That was what it was. It was the edges of all of these photographs. But there in the edges of these pictures in this newspaper, we saw that the editor-in-chief of that Sunday morning newspaper must have been quite clever so as to drive the point home to his readership. He only picked photographs and pictures of Kristallnacht in Hamburg, not the infamous photographs that you all know of encyclopedias and school textbooks of Kristallnacht in Berlin, Vienna, or Frankfurt, but rather this was a local newspaper with local pictures for the local populace. We were now going through these photographs a third time, this time no longer focused on the terror and the destruction portrayed in the centers of these photographs, but now only frozen and studying the edges of the photographs, for there in the edges of these pictures, we were identifying landmarks, buildings, intersections, naming street corners and neighborhoods. All of a sudden, history got a little bit too close for comfort as we realized this horrendous event known as Kristallnacht had taken place merely 10 years before my birth, right outside our kitchen window. No longer was something like this history packed away in some storybook fashion that you could merely close the book, put it on the shelf. History was right outside our kitchen window, and it shook us to our very core. We knew that we had to make our way to church that Sunday morning, as I was employed there. And as we were putting on our overcoats, I glanced back over my shoulder to see the newspaper on the kitchen table, and I knew that I had to physically turn my back to it, but I knew that we would be occupying ourselves, because as we walked out of the front door of our apartment building, we walked back into the streets of Kristallnacht. The only qualitative difference now was that the photographs in the newspaper were two-dimensional black and white. Now we seem to be walking in the same streets in full color in three dimensions. Needless to say, that Sunday afternoon we came back home and we devoured all the articles in that section D about Kristallnacht and set ourselves a task to investigate everything there is about Kristallnacht. Also, we had gone around the city of Hamburg with this newspaper section, with the news, with the pictures in it, and gone to each one of the areas of the photographs. We actually ended up playing sort of a facetious type of game, trying to see if we could stand in the same place that the photographer had stood in 40 years later, reformat over, and see what's there today. We did that with our bicycles riding around. Some places it was just merely an apartment building. Some places the street wasn't there anymore. It was rerouted. But at one place, that little eighth of a size photograph of that huge cathedral-like synagogue going down in flames, that really shook us, simply because I actually located the place where the photographer had stood and had it over and just looked at it. What was there today? Much to our shock and chagrin, today, 40 years later, 1978, that huge area where that huge central synagogue of Hamburg's Jewish community had once stood, the Joseph Karlebach Schule, was today nothing more than an ignominious parking lot, but a parking lot that was right in the hub of the university, a parking lot attached to the Department of Library Science, one that I would walk across from my institute to the main university library and back again, but in those days never realizing where my feet were treading. Why? Because in those days, in 1978, there was no plaque, there was no shield, there was no sign proclaiming to the whole world that on this parking lot area had once stood the huge central synagogue of Hamburg's Jewish community, a Jewish community that had numbered well over 31,000 strong before Adolf Hitler Mach Shemo had come to power, was now reduced to a simple, ignominious parking lot where the students were just happy at the university to have a place to drop their car and run off to classes. My wife and I, when we got down there, we walked around the perimeter of this parking lot area with the photograph. It was a shock. It was a very dismal day, drizzly, and all of a sudden we seemed to be all by ourselves and we were identifying this historical location. But for my wife and I, that particular day, we designated it as more than just a historical location. We designated that parking lot as sacred territory. I don't know why, but we just knew that this was a very holy ground and that something very, very destructive and blasphemous had taken place here. And we designated that it not only as holy territory, but we refused to walk across it with our feet, knowing what had transpired there in history. Needless to say, this triggered off a much more in-depth research into Kristallnacht. It led on into the research about the Holocaust itself. We wanted to know a simple question that triggered off our interest into the Holocaust, and that was, we wanted to know, why was Adolf Hitler Mach Shemo so intimidated by the Jews, the smallest of the smallest ethnic group on the planet Earth? We wanted to know, why was the focus there? And then that led into a larger question of anti-Semitism throughout the ages. And then obviously, as a churchman, as a theologian, I had to go back and say, what was the response of the church to the Kristallnacht? What was the response of the church during the Holocaust? And then go backwards throughout history. My wife and I did some very soul-searching and very incriminating questions. I know what I look like before you today. You're having difficulty, the cognitive dissonance and the visual dissonance of seeing a hush of a rabbi, or at least a hussid, let's say that, in front of you talking like a minister. However, changes can happen. And the change happened by my wife and I in our lives. But we had to go back and ask some very soul-searching and very incriminating questions. Kristallnacht for sure was a pogrom that swept across all of what we today know as unified or greater Germany, as well as Austria, as well as part of the Czech Republic, the Sudetenland. And on November the 10th, 1938, starting at 2 a.m. in the morning and sweeping until 6 p.m. the following evening, in 16, not weeks, not days, but 16 short hours in every city, town, and village across these three large countries of Western Europe, over 1,400 synagogues, yeshivas, and Beis Yaakovs were systematically burnt to the ground. An additional 7,500 shops, but only Jewish shops, were looted and plundered. 30,000 prominent Jews from the main metropolitan areas and cities were arrested, taken out to camps for registration, and 91 other Jews were murdered, all within 16 hours. And now comes the kicker to this. Kristallnacht took place 10 months before World War II broke out. So my wife and I had to ask, in that 10-month hiatus between Kristallnacht and the outbreak of World War II, a major conflagration that threw the world into turmoil, my wife and I had to go back and ask some very soul-searching questions, especially upon the two pillars that we'd built our lives, namely academics at university and Christianity in the church. The first battery of questions was as follows. Here we were, representatives of the Christian church. We had to go back and ask, following the weeks and months after Kristallnacht, when a voice of protest could have been and should have been heralded out to possibly awaken the moral conscience of Western Christendom, we had to go back and ask, where were all of our Protestant ministers and Catholic priests? Where were our role models, our theologians that would get up loftily in their pulpit, as I myself was now doing, following in their footsteps, preaching out every Sunday morning, a gospel of turning the other cheek? My wife and I went back and did a review of church history over the past 1900 years. However, this time, when we looked at the sweep of Western civilization, we did it from a different point of view. It was almost like taking the telescope and turning it around the other way. We looked at it at a different point of view than is normally taught at universities. At universities, whenever you learn the sweep of Western civilization, ironically enough, it's always taught from the dominant power position, namely the Holy Roman Empire, which if you reflect on your history studies, you remember was neither Holy Roman nor an empire, but that's what history is. Rather, this time we looked at the point of view of Jewish communities that had to live under the yoke of the so-called Holy Roman Empire. And from that perspective, it gradually dawned on us just whose cheek the church had been turning for all those years, and it had not been their own. But we'd not always been members of the Christian leadership. We'd been laymen growing up through the rank and file. The question there was also pointedly. We went back and started asking some of the older members of the deacons, some of the older ladies of the sisterhood. You know, Kristallnacht was only 40 years ago. It was in the newspaper, we said. Just recently in the newspaper, 40 years ago, Kristallnacht, which predated even the Holocaust. You what, 65, 70 years old? You obviously lived during that time period. We asked them pointedly. Members of our congregation and sister branch congregations, we asked them, what was it like? What was it like to be a Christian on Kristallnacht in peacetime Europe when something could have been done? We asked them, what was it like to open your homes to shelter the persecuted, to feed the hungry? What was it like to go the second mile, to be the good Samaritan instead of sitting around praying about it in theory? What was it like to walk the talk of the gospel? Needless to say, that the more and more we probed, the more and more we became ostracized from our Christian church. We noticed that more graphically by the distant click on the telephone whenever we'd all want to call some of our congregants. We noticed that also on Sunday afternoons in the spring and summer when we would take walks through the city. Hamburg's a lovely city to walk through that time of the year, only to see some of our congregants coming our way, but for them to spot us and cross to the other side of the street, not to have to pass us on the same sidewalk. After a couple of these instances, my wife was getting a bit dour and depressed to try to cheer up with my larky sense of humor. I said, no, how does it now feel to be a new charter member of the local Hamburg leper colony? But we had to go to the second batter of questions. Here I was assistant professor to my supervisor there at the University of Hamburg, had my own office, etc., finishing up hopefully my doctorate and heading up for my first independent teaching position at Cambridge. And now I had to go back and ask, following the weeks and months after Kristallnacht, when something could have been done to possibly avert this oncoming Shoah, we had to go back and ask, where were all of our avant-garde fighters of social justice and university lecturers? Where were our professors of sociology then that would look back glibly on the Kristallnacht and talk about it as a classic example of man's inhumanity to man? Where were these social fighters then, these libertine fighters? Turned out, much to our great chagrin and embarrassment, after my wife and I did a review of Adolf Hitler Maximo's rise to power after he was duly elected by democratic means and appointed as Chancellor of Germany of the Reichstag on January 30, 1933, only to find out, much to our great chagrin and embarrassment, that the first public organizations that openly joined the Nazi Party were none other than my university teaching staff members. First, the medical faculty swore allegiance to the Nazi Party, then the law faculties, followed shortly behind by the misnomered humanities. It seemed to be, upon closer scrutiny, that the two pillars upon which we built our lives, namely Christianity and the church and academics and university, seemed to be not only wobbling, but seemed to be irreparably crumbling beneath our feet the closer that we scrutinized and asked questions. We found that the more we asked these type of questions, the more the leadership of the university and the church were angry at us. I would have thought that, let's clear house. Let's find out what's the truth. That's what you've been teaching me ever since childhood. Or am I that naive that I have to understand that I have to keep my mouth shut and keep going, saying yes and amen to everything? It seemed to be that the more and more we probed and more we scrutinized, the more and more we seemed to stumble onto the so-called big lie of Western civilization. This was a shock to my wife and I. And for sure, thank goodness, we held together. And this was kind of a difficult trip, your first year of marriage, right? What happens was is that we're moving into this week's parsha of Lech Lecha. And somehow or another, not that I saw it lechatchila, but now b'dyavad, I'm seeing more and more that it seemed to be a journey of a latter day Abraham and Sarah that was left their father's home, left their relatives in their home country, and set about in a spiritual no man's land, but following something that they knew was the truth, the seal of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. For sure, obviously, it was a path of discovery, and there were many areas that we discovered that were not only just historical, not only political. Obviously, there were theological discoveries. What happened was is that here we were as representatives of the Christian church, sincere believing Christians. I studied it myself. I didn't have options. We didn't know about Judaism. It was never taught. One of the biggest shocking things later on in our discovery, and you'll have to forgive me that it took me 33 years to discover something that you grew up with. And all of a sudden, as a Christian, it was embarrassing now to look back, as fervent as I was in the church. And yes, even as a teenager, I went to church every Sunday. And I did not sleep during the sermons. I listened. But what happened was I used to play a game with myself listening to the sermons. Because I listened with two ears, one to the content, but secondly, one to the outline of my pastor's sermons. I wanted to see if I could always figure out where he was going and jump to his conclusion before he got there. But he didn't make it very exciting after a while, because I saw that no matter what chapter and verse, what theme he was preaching about, the last 2 minutes were always the same. It was sort of like a two-minute warning in football, or either that or a two-minute warning to the board members to wake up and look intelligent at the end of his sermons. What happened was is that he would always exhort the congregation every Sunday morning. He would conclude by saying, no matter how you've lived your life, you've got to pattern your life after J.C. And I don't mean Julius Caesar either. He's got to be your role model. He has to be your goal in life. You've got to live a life like J.C. Now in hindsight, I shake that I didn't see it. I should have raised my hand at the end of all of his sermons and said, excuse me, Reverend Pastor, but to be more like J.C., we need to get up and convert to Judaism. To find out that his religion was Judaism. I mean, for sure, I get teased quite often as Wade is a funny last name for an Orthodox rabbi, but for heaven's sakes, that's a funny last name for a good Jewish boy, you know? To find out that his religion was Judaism. People always say, you know, that in Christianity, it's the religion about J.C. But I was discovering, together with my wife, JC's own religion. Sure, every now and then I bump into a missionary. I kind of wish I would do more often. They're a lot of fun, you know, at least for me. And they always say, when they hear a little bit about my background, you should see the blood drain from their eyes, you know, when they look at their wife. I really have to be going now, Reverend Rabbi. You know? They end up calling me Reverend Rabbi because they can't figure out whatever. But they always say, no matter what's your path, you've got to come back. You've got to come back to the church. Why? I said, you got to make him your role model. You got to be like him. I said, excuse me, but now as an Orthodox Jew, I'm probably more like JC than you'll ever be. He said, how's that? I said, just like JC never prayed to a man, I don't either. Think about it. But what happens is that real quickly in the time remaining, let's look at some of the struggles and discoveries. And strangely enough, I still find it that I'm sometimes a lone voice in the wilderness, not only educating Jews, but educating the general populace. And unfortunately, the secular Jewish population, which unfortunately is the majority of Am Yisrael, that get wrapped up sometime in Christianity, get swayed, blown away by it, and want to argue is that they're defending it. What happens is that Christianity basically is like an upside-down pyramid. It stands or falls on one basic doctrine. This doctrine is known as the doctrine of the Incarnation. I know it's probably not a hush of a place to talk about Christianity, but hey, I'm also stuck in the fourth parak of Masechta Avodah Zarah. We deal with Avodah Zarah. Why? So that we can destroy it and clear it out and know what it is and not be stumbled by it. What happens is that Christianity, they actually have this conference in the year 325 at Nicaea. Constantine the Emperor, who was a real Machiavellian, even though that's anachronistic, out of order, but he was a real realpolitik. He saw his empire was cracking in half. He needed some super glue to hold it together. And so therefore, he decided to use religion. And he adopted Christianity as the state religion. He even marched forcibly his soldiers through the Tiber River in Rome, forcibly baptizing them as a type of social adhesive to hold his fracturing empire together. But it didn't take more than 12 or 13 years later before he already had a theological crisis on his hands. The east and western sections, where it was politically cracking, now seemed to be cracking theologically. Why? Because they had the church that he had established that he couldn't control now was fracturing out. They didn't have a definition of their main person that they were focused on. This fellow that I commonly call Mr. J or JC Superstar. So what happened was is that in the East they wanted to say that the definition of a human being is like 98% physical and 2% divine. That was their basic definition of a normal Stam human being. But they wanted to say that this fellow JC was like 80% human and 20% divine. In other words, he was much holier than everyone else. In the West, so focused now around Rome and the early makings of the Roman Catholic Church, they wanted to do it the other way. They said he was 80% divine and only 20% human. So they had this conference to hammer out this and to solidify this basic doctrine of who he was and his divinity. There happened to be one small faction at this council that I think really should have won today. They just came in and said, listen, why do we have to schlep there in Nicaea with all this tircha and stuff like that? I'm sure they must have been Jewish or something. But they basically said, why don't we just divide it in half? Say he's 50% human, 50% divine, and let's go home. Well, the two greater parties said, no, we can't do that, because he's only half a man. The other said, no, we can't do that, he's only half a god, so they threw them out. There happened to be a junior deacon that followed or accompanied the Bishop of Alexandria to this council, and he happened to have been a philosopher that converted to Christianity, and he wrote up a small tractate, a rough draft, and gave it to his bishop. That was presented to the Council of Nicaea, and that won the day. And that is today the fundamental principle of Christianity in the Roman Catholic Church and in all the Protestant denominations. And the doctrine goes like this. They said JC is 100% God and 100% man. Lousy mathematics, but they say that's a mystery of the church. It's a mystery belief. What happens is they say it's 100% man, 100% God, and they say it's beyond human comprehension, and so therefore everybody went home satisfied. Nobody had a clue what it meant. But that is still the fundamental principle. We understand that in Yiddishkeit, that is a major, that is a direct steerer to the second of the Osiris of Dibras. Because in Judaism, the second of the Ten Commandments is our definition of a vodazora. You shall not have any other gods beside me. It says, lo pesel v'kol tamuna. No image and no likeness. A minimum of no image, no likeness of Hashem is allowed. In the Gospels, J.C. in some of his public lectures says, I and the Father are one. Which is also bad mathematics, but nevertheless, he actually goes and says, no one comes to the Father except through me. And he actually also says, he who has seen me has seen the Father. I wish I had been in the crowd when he made that statement. Because I would have said, when you say, he who has seen me has seen the Father, I would say, Mr. J, if I can see anything, I can't see the Father. I did get myself into trouble at one university in America because I wasn't so politically correct. Because the students were asking me about this. And I mentioned these three statements. In John's Gospel, I and the Father are one, no one comes to the Father except through me, and he who has seen me has seen the Father. I said, those three statements, is it like a hazaka on a steer of the second of the Cyrus of Dibros? And I said, those three points, that's exactly where we nailed him. Oops. And I was never invited back there again, and probably won't be here either, but nevertheless. Be that as it may, we in Judaism understand. I remember I had a Jewish fellow that had gotten wrapped up in Christianity, and he was trying to macard me to Christianity. And I had some extra time, so I let him chase me all through the Tanakh. Well, I answered all of his questions. Finally, he looked at me and said, you mean to tell me, Rabbi, that there's not one prophecy in the Tanakh, or as he called it, the Old Testament, or as my wife and I today call it, the good Old Testament? He said, there's not one prophecy about JC. I said, oh, there is. You just haven't hit it yet. He said, really? He said, you mean to tell me that you're a secret believer? I said, I'm a believer. I'm just not so secret about it. He said, what? I said, yeah, there's a prophecy about JC. Not only that, but it was one that was fulfilled. He said, really? He said, look, wait a minute. I said, I'm not so sure I like the sound of this. I said, you won't either. Listen to this. We all know what that prophecy is, and it's not somewhere in the Navi. It happens to be in Chumash, a prophecy. Mamish, a prophecy about JC, and it was fulfilled. You all know it when I tell you the name of it. It's the prophecy of the Nevuah of the Navi Sheker. Devarim chapter 13, verses 2 through 6. There, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right there at the end of the life of Moshe Rabbeinu, says he's going to test Am Yisrael. He's going to give them an open book test. And not only that, he's going to tell you the answer to this test that he's going to give us. The only independent variable in this test is, I'm not going to tell you, says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when it's going to happen. Just always steel yourself. Protect yourself. When it happens, you'll know how to behave. Why? Because there will come out a Navi or a dreamer of dreams. And he'll be one of you. He'll be a Jew. And he'll do signs and wonders. Amazing things. JC was a Jew. He certainly dreamed a lot, that's for sure. And he did signs and wonders. I don't even have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with him existing. I don't have a problem with his miracles. As a matter of fact, some people say, why don't you just dismiss the whole thing? Because the only evidence of his life happens to be written by people 40 years after his death that were convinced and wanted to start something. They could have made it up. I said, fine. The only thing is I have so much fun if it's really true. Because he's so guilty. Why? Simply because in that prophecy about the Navi Sheker, Kadosh Baruch Hu says, he will do signs and wonders. He will do prophecies and they'll all come true. It's almost like you can hear Am Yisrael say, well, how do we know he's the false prophet? He said, simply because he'll say, let's go up to God this way. Let's change things a little bit that way. And for sure, JC did exactly that when he said, nobody comes to the Father except through me. We know from the Rambam about the whole concept of Mashiach. That when the real Jewish Mashiach comes, you will not pray to him, you will not pray through him, and if you do, you get skila, I think the commandment is. But rather, when the real Mashiach comes, we'll stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder, facing the same direction. And he will show us and teach us how to really pray. How to really do tachnunim. But if you ever get caught praying to or through the real Messiah, you could lose your head. So what happens is that Hashem says, this Navi Sheker, this prophet, he's going to be Jewish. He's going to do signs and wonders, amazing feats and miracles. But he's going to change things and said, let's worship God this way. Let's go. Not like I brought you out of Mitzrayim. Not what I gave you at Har Sinai. The God that you cannot see. This fellow will try to subvert you a little bit and take you away from the Torah and Mitzvahs and the Yerushalayim that I've taught you. And says HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And so therefore when that person shows up, you are to take him and kill him to to eradicate the evil from your midst. So I happened to mention to one of these missionaries one time, I said, guess what, that prophecy was fulfilled, and if we had a Sanhedrin, I said, you'd be next. You should have seen me back away. We have that prophecy. We know it fits like a shoe. J.C. came, he was Jewish, did signs and wonders, no problem, and he changed things radically, making him the conduit to get to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That we don't allow. What happens is that Christianity still persists. It still thinks that it happens to be the true religion. But interestingly enough, Christianity, they brazenly, in their first gospel, which is called Matthew, they list out a genealogy to prove that J.C. is from the house of David, from King David. The only problem is that three gospels later, in Luke's gospel, in chapter 3, they also list out his genealogy. The problem is that I'm such a nudnik, I actually put these genealogies side by side. And the problem is, as you can see them, in one of the genealogies, you only have 26 grandfathers between King David and J.C. And the other one, you have 41. You got a discrepancy in higher mathematics of 15 generations. A generation is approximately 20 years old. I had one missionary group in South Dakota contact me and said, Rabbi Wade, you didn't look close enough. Why? Because Luke's gospel, that genealogy is Mary's genealogy, and Matthew's gospel is Joseph's genealogy. I wrote back and I said, well, that only means that Mary was 300 years older than Joseph, and whereas I've heard he liked older women, that's kind of pushing it, don't you think? Unbelievable. I had another group to contact me and said, no, it's the other way around. I said, well, that means that Joseph is 300 years older than Mary. But the problem is something that nobody happens to mention. And strangely enough, the church seems to bury this. They'd like to bury this one and not have this one resurrected. But the problem is that when you look at the genealogy side by side, none of the names match. Except in two places, one father and son right in the middle. Everything else is something different. Hello. The problem is that Matthew and Luke were not chavrusas in some yeshiva that sat down and said, you know, I'm going to write up my story about what I like that. We need a genealogy to prove that he's from David, yeah? If they were chavrusas, if they even knew one another, they would have been make sure that they'd have the same genealogy. The problem is that Luke, when he was writing his story about J.C., and Matthew, when he was writing, didn't even know about one another. So therefore, they figured, well, hey, nobody will know the difference. So they get some genealogy out of the Tanakh, stick it in there. And they didn't know somebody else was writing an authoritative, you know, gospel truth. And he pulled some other genealogy. And all of a sudden, you got a major discrepancy. There happens to have been a textbook in my training to be an ordained minister. It was called Gospel Parallels, where they would take the synoptic gospels and parallel out the similar stories that you have in the gospels. When it comes to this one, they have one in the front of the book and the other one in the back, and they pretend as if they're not two genealogies. They don't want to line it up because they've seen it themselves. If that's not hiding the big lie, if that's not stonewalling it, I don't know what is. What happens is that in Judaism, to make a step to get out of Christianity, you could say, yeah, that's poshut. That's the Svara is clear. You had to get out of Christianity once you discovered that it's Avodah Zarah. Yes, not only Catholicism. And by the way, you should understand that yes, Catholicism is a Avodah Zarah, but not from the point of view of statues and icons. Hey, we have our own Rebbe pictures, Lahavdil. But what happens is that all of the Protestant denominations are equally a Avodah Zarah, just like Catholicism. Why? Because no, it's not Shutfus, like the Rambam is talking about. The Rambam is talking about the Eastern Orthodox of what is today known as Greek or Russian Orthodox, Armenian, and Coptic, where they do have a concept of a Shutfus. In the Western Catholic Church and all of the Protestant denominations, it's Mamish Avodah Zarah. It's not a Shutfus relationship. They actually believe that that fellow that walked this planet Earth was God in human form. Hasfeli Lalo'alinu. So what happens is that's a logical step to get out of that, but what's the logical step to get into Judaism? Well, like I said, some people criticize it today. Nobody lechatchila would send your son to university, but I obviously had well over even 17 years of university training in three different continents. And obviously, I think I learned something along the way. It wasn't just like trying to nail jello to the wall. Something stuck along the way, and certain processes of investigation and logical sequences are there. What happens is that we started investigating Judaism.
to see its validity. And it's purely, truly now, bidi evid, to look back, to see those pure hashgacha pratis that I was suggested to do a doctoral dissertation on Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. What a person to start with. Wow. Amazing. Hirsch goes so far as to say that, though he happens to mention quite often in discussions, that he does not term Judaism as a religion. He didn't like to see Judaism as a religion. But he said if he wanted to compare Judaism with all the other religions of the world, he had broad enough shoulders to actually say Judaism would be the only religion that does not believe in God. We know him. Simply because faith and belief, the way I understand emunah and betochen, I translated in the English word trust. Trusting in something you're aware of that you can know and you can verify. And I guarantee you, gentlemen, and I've said this many times in public, that my wife and I would never have converted to Judaism if Judaism was just simply another faith-based religion. Faith. It's a theological notion. Faith and belief. But were you to take those words, faith and belief, translate them into this vernacular, secular terminology, you would have the word opinion. So therefore, instead of the Christian faith, or the Islamic faith, or the Buddhist faith, or the Shinto faith, you'd have the Christian opinion, the Islamic opinion, the Shinto Buddhist opinion. So then you could say, who said your opinion is any better than mine? So what happens is that Judaism, it had to offer us qualitatively something much more solid to rely upon. Otherwise, we could have just stayed where we were. So Judaism offered us exactly that. And without boring you too much, we stumbled into, through Hirsch, who led us into the Ramban, the understanding of the historical verification. And no, I did not participate at that stage in the Discovery Weekends or any of the tapes coming out of the rabbis that were my generation before me, whether of Eshet Torah or Samech, etc. But the historical verification. I worked out the numbers myself at my desk in Hamburg working through Hirsch, and I stumbled on it and figured it out myself. What happens is that, yes, the event at Mount Sinai took place over 3,300 years ago, and a lot of people, a lot of secular Jews, tying it to me. A lot can happen. What about broken telephone and all that sort of stuff? What happens is that you have so many proofs that this event, and I even go so far as to say that the event, the story of the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai, could not have even been made up and assumed to be a man-made story. Why? Simply stating, if I have to answer this question on the street, regalachas, I always tell people, I said, it certainly could not have been made up. Why? Simply because how would you ever get the story going? How could you have ever convinced the teenagers if it didn't happen? You couldn't promise them a Porsche or a Lamborghini. You couldn't promise them 2-year vacation in South America hitchhiking. No. What are you going to do? The teenagers are there and all the adults are trying to press upon everybody. There was this big thunder and lightning storm and God spoke and we all heard him say over the Ten Commandments and stuff like that. And the teenagers say, it didn't happen. Yeah, it was some rain the other night, but hey, you know, you can't read too much into that, you know. If it really didn't happen, how would you ever get it started? And how would you ever convince the teenagers? And we had a lot of them, especially if you count it up. Most of the Mefarshim tell us that approximately 3.25 million Jews have stood at Mount Sinai. But interestingly enough, if you assume that people get married around 20 years old, or maximum 25, let's take the mean, 22 and a half years old, that means that you have 148 forefathers or foremothers between you today and those people of your family that stood at Har Sinai and heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Many of you have been to many Jewish chasanas, major catered affairs, place settings at table 6, 8, 10 people. I want you to think of something much smaller. Imagine for a moment you have a large eating hall, cheder ochel, and all of a sudden you have 33 tables, small tables set up, and at every table you have a place setting for 3, except at one table. There you have a place setting for 4. There you sit, there your father sit, your grandfather, your great-grandfather, but your great-grandfather sits in one of those fancy office swivel chairs, turns around, he's sitting at the next table. Why? Because there his father, your great-great-grandfather is sitting there, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, and he swivels around to the next one. Each one of them is like a miniature Seder table. Because at the end of the Seder, every grandfather, great-grandfather looks down to the end of the table and says, Yankala Moshe, I remember when I was 17, 18 years old, and I sat at the end of my grandfather Zadie's Pesach table. And he said he heard it over from his, and he heard it over from his. How far back do you have to go? It goes around 32 of those 33 tables. Because each one of those great-grandfathers said, yes, I heard it,
And he swivels around from my father, grandfather, great-grandfather. If you want to go by your mother's, you can go by your mother, grandmother, great-grandmother. Or you want to be illegalitarian, you can go your father's mother, mother, father, whatever. But you only go about 32 tables, because you get to the 32nd table, that great-grandfather swivels around and he says something different from everybody else. He swivels around and said, I didn't hear it from my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. What? I stood at Har Sinai with my father, grandfather, great. We all four heard it from a Kaddish Baruch Hu ourselves. That's only 148 great-grandparents between you and Har Sinai today. That's a number you can deal with. It's not 3,300 billion years, you know, and over that. That's 148 generations, assuming that people get married around 22 and a half years old. That's a number we can deal with. But also logically, as far as legal logic, there's something else. Look at Korach. You know the story, of course, you know the story of Korach. The biggest Rasha we had, but he was Moshe's cousin, and he was very wealthy, and it was a big, big Talmud Chacham. And what did he do? He challenged Moshe to the leadership. What was his taina in a court of law? What was his claim against Moshe? He says, Moshe, he says, we all stood at Har Sinai and we heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu just like you. Meaning you didn't hop any more than we did. And so therefore we should have a rotor system. We're all at the same level of Nevi'im or Malachim. We all heard Hashem equally at Har Sinai. So we should have a rotor system and take turn being the leaders. I mean next, of course. You know what happened to Korach? Korach was punished severely. But he wasn't punished because he was an atheist. He wasn't punished because he doubted the event at Har Sinai. He was punished because he challenged Am Yisrael's election or appointment of Moshe Rabbeinu as the conduit. We know what happened. As soon as the Kaddish Baruch Hu finished with Osiris the Dibros, this is Am Yisrael ran backwards. I always wonder in chapter 19 of Shmos, what was the whole deal about building all these barriers? Am Yisrael had three options. Yes, they could have run up the mountain. They could have stood stuck still. Or they could have run backwards. What did they do? They ran backwards. Of course, Kaddish Baruch Hu said, would that they would always be that sneers. Yeah? But what happened when they ran backwards? What did Am Yisrael say? He said, Moshe, Oz, now that we've heard Hashem speak, you be our intermediary. But Am Yisrael is not blind sheep. Every professor of comparative religion around the world, they always talk about, you know, when they get to the chapter about Judaism, they always say, well, you know, the early Hebrews, and when they came out of Egypt, you know, into the wilderness, they were like sheep, you know, slave mentality, give them a bell, they'll follow it anywhere. It obviously shows their ignorance. They never read the Chumash. Why? Melville, who wrote Mutiny on the Bounty, obviously stole his storyline from the Chumash. As soon as Am Yisrael gets out there, they're kvetching. Where's the beef? Where's room service? Where's the water? Where's this? Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch actually says in his commentary, you see the nascent beginning of Jewish humor with the first complaint. Am Yisrael's first complaint, they get out there and they say, but Moshe, there weren't enough graves in Egypt, you had to bring us out here to die. I mean, this is not a slave mentality, this is not passive sheep. They're ready to bolt any time. Let's go back to our flesh pots in Egypt. Let's go back to Egypt. We had, you know, okay, it was tough, but at least we had Parnassah. We had our homes. We had our Jewish communities. You know, we had our JCCs and our Jewish country clubs. Oops. They were ready to bolt at every moment. We know the stories of Moshe speaking to Hashem, exhausted. You know, these people, this is a rebellion. They're ready to stone me, you know. It's interesting, one time, the repartee between Moshe and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know. Moshe says, yes, when they're bad, they're my people. When they're good, they're your people. What is going on here, you know? Hashem says, what is this people that you brought away? When they're bad, they're mine? What happens is that we see clarity that these were really the Jewish people. They didn't take anything at face value. They would never have appointed Moshe as the intermediary between God had they not heard it first themselves. As they went back, they said, Oz, now that we've heard Hashem speak, now Moshe, you be. That's my good old, loving, true-to-life Jewish people that I'm happy to have joined. They don't take private revelation. In America, they had these evangelicals on television. One of them got in financial trouble. He got on his television gospel network and he said, God spoke to me Thursday night and I'm ailing $8 million by the end of March. Sad thing was, he got it.
He got that $8 million in 2.5 months. I went to my Rosh Yeshiva. I said, I don't think it's my team for you to schlep around all over the world, you know, and drag around in them bus stations and go snoring, you know. Why don't you just stand up and say, God spoke to me last Thursday night and I'm mailing $8 million to my yeshiva.
He said, Rav Asher, he says, Am Yisrael is a little bit more cynical and a little bit more clever than that.
I said, well, it's worth a try.
What happens is that this is exactly what my wife and I were looking for. We were looking for verifiable evidence. We got more than we even bargained for because, as I've said many times before, the event at Har Sinai, that is recorded in our Chumash. And no, it's not a circular argument. No, it's not proving the Torah from the Torah, but rather it's an inclusive argument, meaning that the independent variable is Am Yisrael. The Jewish people are the only people on the planet Earth that have survived intact for 2,000 years, and they haven't had their own country, haven't had their own capital, haven't had their own flag, haven't had their own army, and have survived intact. Why? Because we took our government with us. We took our Torah, Shulchan Aruch, with us. Wherever we were, we lived by it. We yearned for Am Yisrael, for Eretz Yisrael. Yes, and what happens? Yes, I've studied all the major religions and most of the minor ones. They all have their divine books, and in their divine books they often have prophecies. But Am Yisrael is the only one that has prophecies that have been fulfilled. And strangely enough, the majority of Jews can't be bothered to notice them. God said, yes, if you misbehave. Look at the second parsha of the Kriya Shema. It reads as a business contract. If then, if then. If you learn my Torah and keep my mitzvahs, then I will provide you with your secure land. You'll have your children and in secure borders. If you don't learn my Torah and keep my mitzvahs, then you will be, the earth will lock up like iron, the heavens like copper, and you will be exiled and run off of the land. You only have to have a cursory reading of Jewish history to know that that happened. Look at the days of David HaMelech and Hizkiyahu, Shlomo HaMelech, when we actually got our act together, the Maccabees. Nations of the world used to just come there, even princes and ambassadors, even when they didn't have an appointment with the king, just to walk the streets of Yerushalayim to see a country. They got their act together. Why can't we see that? Why can't we have, like in golf, Lahabdil, the follow-through? Keep it going at least for 3 generations and have a chazakah. And maybe then Hashem will grant us Mashiach. And maybe our final geula. What happens is that my wife and I saw this. And strangely enough, it was as if the scales had been peeled off our eyes. For sure, our jobs had been peeled off of our bodies, that's for sure. I gave up 2 careers. Many people, Jews at the very beginning, couldn't imagine that. You gave up 2 careers? Most people are happy when they have one. I had tenureship in the church. I was very close with my bishop. And I was starting my teaching career at Cambridge, which is not bad. Secondly, you know, as somebody once said, he said, I can't imagine why anybody like that would want to convert. I said, why not? He said, well, it's true. I have met many individuals that wanted to convert to Judaism, but why you? I said, why not me? He said, because you're already married. pardon me. But my wife and I, somehow or another, saw it together. And this is what we found. And at the beginning of every Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, this is Kol Yisrael Yesh Chelek Olam Haba. And many secular Jews and some of my audience still resist. And they say, Rabbi, I remember seeing in the sayings of the fathers, it says, all Jews have a halik and olam haba. I have a portion in the world to come. What do I have to worry about? I said, guess what? You do have a halik and olam haba. The only thing is the Kadosh Baruch Hu doesn't work by automatic bank transfers. You have to get up and go and collect it. That path that you take to go and collect it is called halakha. What does that word literally mean? The path that we take. Walking there. You have to walk the talk. And the path that you take are the instructions of the halacha. So I said, you want your portion? You can come and get it. It's not going to be automatic bank transfer. My wife and I, along our path of discovery, happened to see 2 halakim that were not claimed. We took them. One was named Asher. The other was Naomi. Thank you for your time and attention.